The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week, we will be reading from the edition dated May 20th, 2011. The first story from the main story section of the Week magazine is entitled Opening Bin Laden's Trove of Secrets. What happened? U.S. intelligence officers last week discovered evidence that al-Qaeda was planning to derail American trains on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 as they pored over the vast haul of documents, hard drives, and DVDs recovered from Osama bin Laden's Pakistan hideout. That plot, described by Representative Peter King, the chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, as a rambling aspiration, was the first piece of intelligence made public following the raid that killed bin Laden. U.S. officials said that similar intel nuggets were being pulled every hour from the trove, which includes 220 million pages of digital text and bin Laden's handwritten journal with plans for future operations. President Obama said that al-Qaeda could be dealt a fatal blow if the U.S. followed through aggressively on this information. But the president's aggressive tactics were criticized by bin Laden's adult sons, who said Obama had blatantly violated international law by ordering their father's execution. In a joint letter to the New York Times, the family said it wanted to know why an unarmed man was not arrested and tried in a court of law. The statement, written by bin Laden's son Omar, 30, who has denounced his father's attacks on civilians, also called on the U.S. to release the photo of bin Laden's body, as the family was not convinced of his death. Obama had previously ruled out publishing the image, which he said could be used as a propaganda tool to incite violence. Here's what the editorials had to say. Obama made the wrong call over bin Laden's death photo, said the Boston Globe. While it's true the image could rile up some of bin Laden's followers, the absence of any photographic evidence will likely allow dangerous conspiracy theories to develop. More important, this raid was done in the name of the American people, who should be able to see the results. Publishing these shots would have been a betrayal of our ideals, said the Los Angeles Times. Obama's refusal to disseminate graphic photographs echoes our nation's conviction that war is not an excuse to degrade the enemy. Bin Laden may have been a vicious terrorist, but that's no cause for desecration of his remains or the exposition of his wounds. A picture's publication would have failed to quell the doubts of conspiracy theorists, said the Portland Oregonian. Despite evidence to the contrary, these people still believe that 9/11 was an inside job. So let's take Obama at his word, not to mention al-Qaeda's confirmation, and accept that we won't see Osama bin Laden walking the earth again. And now here's what the columnists had to say. The haul of documents and data from bin Laden's compound should make al-Qaeda's friends and leaders feel a real fear, said James Andrew Lewis in Newsday. As they trawl through the data, U.S. agents might find clues pointing to al-Qaeda's wealthy Arabian funders and how the terror organization's regional franchises are led and how to get in touch with them. Unfortunately, the Obama administration's failure to keep a zipped lip means a lot of this intelligence might now be useless, said Peter Brooks in the New York Post. Instead of broadcasting our find, we should have waited a while so we could more fully exploit some of the windfall before al-Qaeda took defensive measures. By blabbing about our successes, Obama has made it harder for us to collect intelligence in the future and potentially put our forces in harm's way. The failure to take bin Laden alive has also undermined our fight against al-Qaeda, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. We should have taken the terror leader to a secret location for interrogation and waterboarded him until he gave up every possible lead. But since Obama thinks coercive interrogation is un-American, there was only one good option for bin Laden, a bullet in the eye. But can you imagine the problems we'd face if bin Laden had been captured? Asked Jeff Greenfield in the Washington Post. He'd likely have been kept at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, as it would have been too risky to put him on trial in Guantanamo. And the legal questions would be nothing next to the security consequences of taking him alive. Terrorists could seize schools in India and threaten to execute every pupil unless bin Laden was freed. Soon we'd all be wishing that the SEALs had pushed that bastard out of the helicopter when they first nabbed him. Our next item from the main story section of the Week magazine this week is the jobs outlook improving. What happened? The U.S. economy added 244,000 jobs in April, its third straight month of solid gains and the biggest net monthly jobs boost since 2006. The private sector led the charge, surprising Wall Street and vindicating optimists who had claimed that the tepid growth of the first quarter was behind us. This isn't a flash in the pan, said Austin Goolsbee, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers at the White House. For 3 months running, private sector employment has climbed by an average of 250,000 jobs a month. We're not out of the woods, said Heather Bushey, head economist for the Center for American Progress. April's sunny jobs report was marred by an uptick in the unemployment rate from 8.8 to 9%. That is due largely to the loss of 24,000 federal, state, and local government jobs last month, part of a year-long decline of 400,000 public sector jobs. For this struggling economy, it looks like two steps forward, one step back, said economist Stephen Stanley at Pierpoint Securities. Now here's what the editorial said. The jobless expansion continues, said Investors Business Daily. We're not impressed with April's numbers, since a quarter of those new jobs came from McDonald's. Nothing against Mickey D, which added 62,000 jobs in April. But economic growth can't be sustained with burger flippers. And the truth is, the big jobs picture is not improving. Add in those who'd given up looking and part-timers searching for full-time work, and the actual unemployment rate shoots up to 15.9%. When the economy bogs down for this long, it's almost always due to bad policies. More like the lack of any policy, said the New York Times. Congress and the White House are so preoccupied with budgets and deficits that they're ignoring jobs creation. That has resulted in deep pockets of distress in the country. 22% unemployment for high school grads under 25, and 16.1% for black workers. Where are the jobs? It's time this administration started looking for answers. They might start with the rising price of gasoline, the most recent roadblock to recovery, said the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. There's no economic justification for the spike in oil we've seen since the uprising in Libya, which accounts for just 2% of the world's oil. If prices at the pump remain high this summer, Congress should strip away big oil subsidies and tax excessive profits. We can't let price gougers get away with hobbling the economy. Now here's what the columnist said about all of this. The good news was what didn't happen in April, said Neil Irwin in the Washington Post. Even struggling with higher prices for gasoline, food, and raw materials, employers refused to circle the wagons. Instead, they created thousands of new jobs, confident that consumers will still go shopping. Yes, jobs are being created, said Andy Kroll and Mother Jones, but too many of them are low-wage, dead-end jobs that won't support a family in the present lopsided recovery. Decent-paying jobs like the ones that allowed America's middle class to expand in the 20th century are going the way of typewriters and landline telephones. The April numbers are not a signal of green shoots, but of the perils of premature belt-tightening, said Robert Kuttner in HuffingtonPost.com. With the U.S. workforce still a million people smaller than it was a year ago, government should be adding jobs, not cutting them. Instead, austerity fever is sweeping both parties, pushing the idea of promoting public jobs off the table. This report shows we have a long way to go, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post, but Congress keeps following the wrong map. The minority parties in the House and Senate did release competing jobs agendas last week. House Democrats want more short-term worker support, and Senate Republicans seek long-term structural reform, goals that could be addressed in a compromise bill. But nothing will happen until the real powers in Washington, the Republican House, the Democratic Senate, and the White House, get serious about promoting job growth. You're listening to The Week magazine for May 20th, 2011. Thanks for joining us today. The controversy of the week this week was entitled Pakistan, Was the U.S. Betrayed by Its Ally? Osama bin Laden wasn't the only casualty of this month's raid in Abbottabad, said Capel Cormoretti in the Chicago Tribune. With him died the myth of Pakistan as an ally in the war against terrorism. The fact that bin Laden was able to live comfortably for years within walking distance of the Pakistan Military Academy confirms what U.S. officials have suspected since 9/11, that Islamabad has been quietly nurturing and offering sanctuary to terrorists while pretending to be a strategic partner of the U.S. No more, said Investors Business Daily in an editorial. Since 9/11, we've sent nearly $20 billion in aid to this so-called war ally, on the understanding that it would help us fight terrorism in the region. Now we know that Islamabad looked the other way as bin Laden set up a luxury villa in Abbottabad. Pakistan's political and military leaders actually have the gall to complain that we violated their sovereignty in killing the world's most wanted terrorists. Freezing aid seems a no-brainer. Alliances aren't the same as friendships, said the Los Angeles Times. We've known since 9/11 about the double game being played by Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI. That's why President Obama chose not to brief Pakistan ahead of time about the bin Laden raid, and why he even authorized the SEALs to shoot their way out of Abbottabad if Pakistani forces confronted them. But reducing or ending foreign aid to punish the country for its duplicity would be a step too far, especially as we are still fighting a war in neighboring Afghanistan. Would cutting aid change Pakistani behavior for the better? Said Reza John in the NewYorkTimes.com. Obviously not. President Asif Ali Zardari is not a popular figure in Pakistan, and Islamic extremists would love to seize power. Pakistan, let us remember, has 100 nuclear weapons and a large, restless, and mainly poor population. We must play the country's double game because the alternative is far worse. The alternative is making an enemy of Pakistan, said the San Francisco Chronicle, and that could destabilize the whole region and hurt our efforts to drive terrorists out of neighboring Afghanistan. But we may have little choice if the trove of intelligence seized from bin Laden's compound shows he was being sheltered by the ISI and the military. At the very least, said the Wall Street Journal, such a discovery would entitle us to issue Pakistan a Bushian ultimatum. Stop the double game and join us, or we'll do the job ourselves, and with other friends, such as the Indians, if need be. That could bring some badly needed clarity to this dysfunctional relationship. Pakistan has to decide whose side it's on. Let's not jump to conclusions, said the Christian Science Monitor. It's possible that no one in authority knew about bin Laden's hiding place. The U.S. should use that possibility to impress upon the Pakistani government and the public just how much Pakistan needs America's help to fend off terrorists. What Pakistan really needs, said Lawrence Wright in The New Yorker, is a shift of power from the ruling elite and the military to the civilian middle class. So let's deliver our future aid in the form of trade deals and tax breaks for Pakistani businesses. That would do far more to enhance Pakistan's stability and to ensure its friendship than the billions of dollars that America now pays like a ransom. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the popular column entitled Good Week for and Bad Week for. Well, it was a good week for political exposure after 29-year-old Representative Aaron Schock, a Republican from Illinois, lived up to his nickname as Washington's hottest congressman and the ripped representative by appearing bare-chested on the cover of Men's Health magazine, displaying his washboard abdominals. It was a good week for American capitalism after Maurice Harari of New York City made $120,000 in 48 hours by selling a line of T-shirts celebrating the death of Osama bin Laden. Harari, who is 23 years old, set up the website OsamaDeadTees.com just 4 hours after the terrorist death was announced. And it was a good week for seeing Rome without the crowds after an internet rumor forecasting a devastating earthquake on May 11th shut businesses and caused almost 1 in 5 residents to flee the eternal city. And it was a bad week for Donald Trump, whose 15 minutes as a viable Republican Party presidential candidate appeared to be over. The real estate magnate's poll numbers plummeted from 26% to 8%, pushing him from first to fifth place in the GOP field. And, of course, as we know, he dropped out of the field earlier this week. It was a bad week for chocolate milk, which may be withdrawn from school cafeterias and vending machines across the country for its high sugar content. Chocolate milk is soda in drag, said one nutritionist. It does not belong in schools. And it was a bad week for the presumption of innocence after a man charged with assault and battery appeared in a South Carolina court with a tattoo on his forehead that said, "Please forgive me if I say or do anything stupid. Thank you." And now let's turn to the People section from the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled Stewart's End-of-Life Worries. Patrick Stewart has no intention of suffering a long, lingering death, said Giles Hattersley in the London Times. The actor, best known for his role on Star Trek, has joined a British organization called Dignity in Dying, which wants to make it legal for terminally ill people to end their own lives at a time of their choosing. To be trapped in a painful body, to lose those elements of communication, of sharing, and not to be able to act terrifies me, says Stewart, who is 70 years old. His convictions were deepened by the experience of a friend's wife, who suffered horribly with an illness before ending her life in the most ghastly way. He got a rude reminder of his own mortality 5 years ago when he suffered chest pains during a brisk walk. The doctor said, "You have coronary heart disease, 85% blockage." He said then, "What are you doing this afternoon?" I said, "I'm going to lunch at Paramount." He said, "We'd rather you didn't." 10 minutes later, he was lying on a gurney headed for surgery. He's now fine, but when the time for dying comes, Stewart wants the right to beam himself up rather than become incapacitated. The decision has to be made while you can still make the decision. The astronaut who came fourth. Alan Bean has always been the astronaut no one remembers, said James M. Clash in Bloomberg.com. That's what happens when you're the fourth man on the moon. Bean, who is 79 now, was part of Apollo 12, the second manned lunar landing. Like Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin of the previous mission and his own mission mate Pete Conrad, Bean walked on the moon. But when his boots hit the surface, it was no longer historic. "I didn't have any first words," says Bean. "I didn't think anything philosophical. It was all business." He admits to some envy of his predecessors, especially Armstrong. When he watched Armstrong struggling to find a landing site during Apollo 11, Bean says he felt a twinge of schadenfreude. Let's say you're the backup quarterback in the Super Bowl and the game is on the line and the quarterback's limping. You're thinking, he's a better quarterback and we want to win the game. But at the same time, maybe I ought to get in there. I can win the game. Since retiring from NASA in 1981, he's been painting and selling space scenes, mixing moon dust from his spacesuit into the paint. He knows his paintings would be worth a lot more if they hadn't been fourth, if he hadn't been fourth. Everybody wishes they were the first man on the moon, he says. And our next item, Wilde's newsy upbringing. Olivia Wilde has the news in her blood, said Carol Radiswill in Glamour magazine. The actress, who is 27, is the daughter of famed journalists Andrew and Leslie Cockburn. Her uncles, Alexander and Patrick, also made their mark in the newspaper trade. I remember the dining room table was covered with every newspaper from 8 in the morning until night, Wilde says. Her parents often filled the house with celebrities interested in world affairs. They had these epic dinner parties. I would always crawl under the table and just listen. I remember Mick Jagger talking politics with my parents. Because of her political upbringing, she felt an obligation to do aid work in Haiti after the earthquake last year. I would write, my mother, email saying, "Today we got caught in a riot. Then there was a shooting, and later we were at a morgue," Wilde recalls. Most mothers would write back, "Be careful." But she writes, "Send me more. Find out what's going on with so-and-so." It was an incredible bonding experience. I never wanted to be a journalist, but I can't tell you how profound it's been to realize that my mother is so within me. And now let's turn to the briefing section from the Week magazine. This week, the title of our briefing is "The Navy SEALs, the commandos who killed Osama bin Laden, are highly trained, fearless, and lethal. How do they get that way?" What are the Navy SEALs? Named for the environments in which they are trained to work, sea, air, and land, the SEALs are an elite unit of the U.S. Special Operations Command. The 2,500 SEALs are considered some of the nation's finest soldiers. SEALs maintain fitness levels close to the human maximum and also must have exceptional eyesight, above-average intelligence, and nearly superhuman pain tolerance. They are trained to develop an iron determination to fulfill their mission, no matter what. In a now legendary display of the spirit of these commandos, Marcus Luttrell and three other SEALs held off more than 100 Taliban fighters after an ambush in Afghanistan in 2005, when Luttrell was blown off a cliff by a rocket-propelled grenade. He crawled 7 miles with 3 broken vertebrae and a bullet in his leg to get help. He killed 6 Taliban fighters along the way. When were they formed? Well, the SEALs were created by President John F. Kennedy in 1962 and received their first taste of combat in the Vietnam War. The Viet Cong dubbed them the men with green faces for the way they seemed to spring from the ground to kill or kidnap guerrilla leaders. Since then, they have fought in Grenada, Panama, Somalia, Bosnia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. They are usually sent into conflicts where there is no traditional battleground, in which stealth, discipline, and a lethal skill set are paramount. How are SEALs chosen? Well, through an extremely arduous 2-year-long training regime that tests both mental and physical strength and weeds out 75% to 90% of the applicants. In drown-proofing, trainees are bound hand and foot, thrown into deep water, and told to get to the surface somehow while holding their breath and then to swim 50 meters while still tied up. In sugar cookie drills, wet trainees are forced to roll in the sand before doing push-ups, sit-ups, and sprints that leave their bodies chafed, sore, and bleeding. Worse still is Hell Week, in which trainees are kept awake 20 hours a day performing relentless, physically punishing drills while being constantly invited to quit. Former SEAL Howard Wasden describes being hosed with freezing cold water to induce hypothermia, then forced to swim 2 miles through the ocean. When he emerged, Wasden was handed a mug of steaming hot chocolate by an instructor and told he could only drink if he admitted failure and dropped out of the SEAL program. Handing him back that cup of hot chocolate was the hardest thing I'd ever done, he says. What kind of people are these guys, anyway? Well, many SEALs don't fit the crew-cut, clean-shaven military stereotype. They are more likely to be bearded with a rough look like a street urchin, says former SEAL Richard Marcinko, so that they don't stick out. Many are former college athletes with exceptional agility and upper body strength. They're quiet and self-effacing in public, operating under a mandate of total secrecy, but the brutal nature of their training makes them fearless. They've learned to compartmentalize it, says former Navy psychologist Mark Russell. Their training takes over and allows them to overcome whatever fear response they may have. Who killed Osama bin Laden? The SEALs will never say, but he was one of the 24 members of SEAL Team 6 who charged into bin Laden's compound. ST-6, as it's called, is a special black ops unit made up of the top soldiers from each of the 9 other SEAL units. Operating under a cloak of secrecy outside of military protocol and often international law, the unit's members specialize in targeted assassinations and snatch-and-grab missions, requiring lots of experience, tremendous precision, and cool decision-making. In 2009, ST-6 snipers killed 3 Somali pirates with simultaneous headshots from a bobbing ship 40 yards away. ST-6 is made up of experienced soldiers, many in their 30s, who have more than 100 operations under their belts. What is their recent record of success? Mostly impressive. Special Operations Forces reportedly killed or captured nearly 3,000 Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters and leaders in Afghanistan over a recent 90-day period. But the Navy SEALs do make mistakes. Last year, ST-6 inadvertently killed British aid worker Linda Norgrove during a botched rescue attempt in Afghanistan. The SEALs' reputation was tarnished, too, by an incident in 2008, when an ill-planned firefight in Pakistan left several civilians dead. The casualties were caught on cell phone video, forcing the U.S. military to acknowledge the covert mission and apologize for it. What motivates the SEALs? It's not money. A Navy SEAL is paid about $54,000 a year and is expected to spend up to 300 days a year in deployment. Most SEALs do as many as 15 tours in their lifetimes, but leave the service with little more than a standard military pension. Elite soldiers have motivations that are hard for other people to understand, says Eric Haney, a former member of the Army's Delta Force Commando Unit. Some people are driven to this. Just be damn glad they are. And the footnote to this briefing section is entitled, A SEAL's Best Friend. The Navy SEALs who stormed Osama bin Laden's hideaway last week had support from a heavily armored four-legged soldier, a bomb-sniffing combat canine described by the New York Times as the nation's most courageous dog. The military pooch was likely equipped with the very latest in military technology, a canine tactical assault suit with wireless infrared cameras and a built-in speaker to hear its trainer's orders. The unit's dogs, German Shepherds or Belgian Malinois, can alert the SEALs to the presence of suicide belts or other explosives and are trained to chase down fleeing suspects, bite them on the leg or arm, and hold them for capture. SEALs are the deadliest fighting force on the planet, said former SEAL Brandon Webb. You better believe these dogs are just the same. Now it's time for us to take a look at the best columns in the United States for this past week, according to The Week magazine. Our first column is entitled, It's Still the Economy, Stupid. Jonah Goldberg is the author here in the NationalReview.com. Anyone who thinks the death of Osama bin Laden makes President Obama unbeatable, said Jonah Goldberg, ought to look at what happened in 1992. President George H.W. Bush saw his approval rating soar to 89% after driving Iraqi forces out of Kuwait in 1991 and then lost to Bill Clinton the following year. It's not a perfect analogy. Obama doesn't have a Ross Perot-type figure nipping at his heels, but it is instructive. One of the key reasons Bush lost in 92 was because he focused so heavily on Saddam Hussein and foreign policy, while voters were mostly concerned with the economic pain of a recession. Well, the Great Recession of recent years was far more unnerving, and the tepid recovery now underway has hardly erased doubts that Obama has been a capable steward of the economy. Bin Laden's death, ironically, puts the spotlight right back on domestic problems. If the Republicans want to win in 2012, they'll select a nominee similar to Bill Clinton, who focuses like a laser on the economy. Obama can be beaten, Bin Laden bounces, notwithstanding. The next column is entitled, Don't Blame Voters for the Fiscal Crisis, and this one was written by Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Stop blaming the public, said Paul Krugman. The self-appointed wise men of the country's policy elite have recently taken to claiming that selfish, short-sighted voters caused the U.S. budget deficit and economic meltdown by clamoring for goodies they couldn't pay for. The truth is that our current miseries were caused by foolish policies promoted by the policy elite, not by ordinary voters. Take the Bush tax cuts, rammed through by fervent supply-siders who insisted they'd pay for themselves and then some. Instead, they've added $2 trillion to the national debt. The costly Iraq War, that was brought to us by an elite circle of neocons who cooked up a highly deceptive sales campaign. How about the reckless deregulation of Wall Street banks that led to the catastrophic fiscal collapse? That was the work of economic policymakers such as former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, who assured us that the unregulated trading of derivatives would be in the country's best interest. The lesson, unless we're more skeptical of powerful experts pushing nonsensical policies, they'll do even more damage in the years ahead. And the next column is entitled, Not So Exceptional After All, and it's written by Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. America alone among nations is beloved of God. That belief, called American exceptionalism, has now become a defining belief of the right and its favored presidential candidate, said Richard Cohen. Exceptionalists like Newt Gingrich contend that the secular left is far too critical and negative about America and its history, which they say provides proof of God's handiwork. Now, I do believe that our country's astounding capacity for tolerance and melting pot diversity makes it unique, but the idea that America is specially blessed and thus better than everywhere else in the world would seem to defy evidence. Our murder rate is much higher than most other modern nations, and our prisons bulge with millions of citizens. Our school system is largely dysfunctional, producing millions of students who can't read or do math. Our health care system allows sick people to go broke. And our politics is so rancorous that America can't solve its problems or pay its bills. American exceptionalism ought to be called American narcissism. We look perfect only to ourselves. And you're listening to The Week Magazine. Thanks for joining us today on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we're going to turn to the end of the magazine called The Week with the Last Word. And this particular issue is entitled, Made Up Minds. Since political beliefs are rooted in emotion, says Chris Mooney, the facts are often irrelevant. A man with a conviction is a hard man to change. Tell him you disagree, and he turns away. Show him facts or figures, and he questions your sources. Appeal to logic, and he fails to see your point. So wrote the celebrated Stanford University psychologist Leon Festinger in a passage that might have been referring to arguments over the president's birthplace or the causes of climate change and autism. But it was too early for all of that. This was the 1950s, and Festinger was actually describing what would become a famous case study in psychology, a group of Chicago UFO devotees who thought they were communicating with extraterrestrials. On December 21, 1954, the day the cult leaders had said the world would end in cataclysm, Festinger and his team were with the Seekers, whom they had decided to study. This was the moment he was waiting for. How would people so emotionally invested in a belief system react now that it had been found soundly refuted? When the prophecy failed, the group struggled for an explanation. But then rationalism set in. A new message arrived from the aliens, announcing that the Seekers had been spared at the last minute. Festinger summarized the extraterrestrials' new pronouncement. The little group sitting all night long had spread so much light that God had saved the world from destruction. From that day forward, the Seekers, previously shy of the press and indifferent toward evangelizing, began to proselytize. Their sense of urgency was enormous, wrote Festinger. The devastation of all they had believed had made them even more certain of their beliefs. In the annals of denial, it doesn't get more extreme than that. The cultists lost their jobs, the press mocked them, and there were efforts to keep them away from impressionable young minds. But though the Seekers might lie at the far end of the spectrum of human self-delusion, there's plenty to go around. And since Festinger's day, an array of new discoveries in psychology and neuroscience has further demonstrated how our pre-existing beliefs, far more than any new facts, can skew our thoughts and color what we consider our most dispassionate and logical conclusions. This tendency toward motivational reasoning helps explain why we find groups still polarized over matters where the evidence is so unequivocal. It seems that expecting people to be convinced by the facts flies in the face of, you know, the facts. The theory of motivated reasoning builds on a key insight of modern neuroscience. Reasoning is actually suffused with emotion, what researchers often call affect. Not only are the two inseparable, but our positive or negative feelings about people, things, and ideas arise much more rapidly than our conscious thoughts in a matter of milliseconds, fast enough to detect with an EEG device, but long before we're aware of them. That shouldn't be surprising. Evolution required us to react very quickly to stimuli in our environment. It's a basic human survival skill, explains political scientist Arthur Lupia of the University of Michigan. We push threatening information away. We pull friendly information close. We apply fight or flight reflexes not only to predators, but to data itself. In other words, by the time we're consciously reasoning, we may instead be rationalizing our prior emotional commitments. Or to use an analogy offered by University of Virginia psychologist Jonathan Haidt, we may think we're being scientists, but we're actually being lawyers. Our reasoning is a means to a predetermined end, winning our case, and is shot through with biases. These include confirmation bias, in which we give greater heed to evidence and arguments that bolster our beliefs, and disconfirmation bias, in which we expend disproportionate energy trying to refute views and arguments that we find uncongenial. Plainly put, if I don't want to believe that my spouse is being unfaithful or that my child is a bully, I can go to great lengths to explain away behavior that seems obvious to everybody else. Modern science originated from an attempt to weed out such subjective lapses. What Francis Bacon, that great 17th century theorist of the scientific method, dubbed the idols of the mind. Our individual responses to the conclusions that science reaches, however, are quite another matter. Because researchers employ so much nuance and disclose so much uncertainty, scientific evidence is highly susceptible to selective reading. Giving ideologues or partisans scientific data that's relevant to their beliefs is like unleashing them in the motivated reasoning equivalent of a candy store. And it's not just that people twist or selectively read scientific evidence to support their pre-existing views. According to research by Yale law professor Dan Kahan and his colleagues, people's deep-seated views about morality and about the way society should be ordered strongly predict whom they consider to be a legitimate scientific expert in the first place, and thus where they consider scientific consensus to lie on contested issues. Kahan classified individuals based on their cultural values as either individualists or communitarians, and as either hierarchical or egalitarian in outlook. A hierarchical individualist finds it difficult to believe that the things he prizes, commerce, industry, a man's freedom to possess a gun to defend his family, could lead to outcomes deleterious to society. Egalitarian communitarians tend to think that the free market causes harm, that patriarchal families mess up kids, and that people can't handle guns. And the group split dramatically on global warming. But the study subjects weren't anti-science, not in their own minds anyway. It's just that science was whatever they wanted it to be. And that undercuts the standard notion that the way to persuade most people is via evidence and argument. In fact, head-on attempts to persuade can sometimes trigger a backfire effect, where people not only fail to change their minds when confronted with the facts, they may hold their wrong views more tenaciously than ever. Northwestern University sociologist Monica Prasad and her colleagues wanted to test whether they could dislodge the belief that Saddam Hussein and an al-Qaeda were secretly collaborating among those most likely to believe it, Republican partisans from highly GOP-friendly counties. So the researchers set up a study in which they discussed the topic with the subjects. Then they cited the findings of the 9/11 Commission, as well as a statement by George W. Bush himself, denying that his administration had ever said the 9/11 attacks were orchestrated between Saddam and al-Qaeda. As it turns out, not even Bush's own words could change the minds of these Bush voters. Just one of the 49 partisans who originally believed the Iraqi al-Qaeda claim changed his or her mind. A far more common reaction was resisting the facts, either by coming up with counterarguments or by simply being unmovable. But how irrational is this in the end? On one hand, it doesn't make sense to discard an entire belief system built up over a lifetime because of some new snippet of information. It is quite possible to say, I reached this pro-capital punishment decision based on real information that I arrived at over my life, explains Stanford social psychologist John Krosnick. Indeed, there's another sense in which science denial could be considered keenly rational. In certain conservative communities, explains Yale's Kahan, people who say, I think there's something to climate change that's going to mark them out as a certain kind of person and their life is going to go less well. If you want to show how and why fact is ditched in favor of motivated reasoning, you could find no better test case than climate change. After all, it's an issue where you have highly technical information on one hand and very strong beliefs on the other. And sure enough, one key predictor of whether you accept the science of global warming is whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. The two groups have grown more divided in their views even as the science becomes more unequivocal. And it turns out that education has little to do with it. On the contrary, in a 2008 Pew survey, only 19% of college-educated Republicans agreed that the planet is warming due to human actions, versus 31% of non-college-educated Republicans. Among Democrats and independents, higher education correlated with greater acceptance of science. Other studies have shown a similar effect. Republicans who say they understand the global warming issue best are least concerned about it. And among Republicans and those with higher levels of distrust of science in general, learning more about the issue doesn't increase one's concern about it. What's going on here? Well, according to political scientists Charles Tabor and Milton Lodge of Stony Brook, one insidious aspect of motivated reasoning is that political sophisticates are prone to be more biased than those who know less about the issues. People who have a dislike of some policy, for example, abortion, if they're unsophisticated, they can just reject it out of hand, says Lodge. But if they're sophisticated, they can go one step further and start coming up with counter-arguments. These individuals are just as emotionally driven and biased as the rest of us, but they're able to generate more and better reasons to explain why they're right, and so their minds become harder to change. Is there a case study of science denial that largely occupies the political left? Yes. The disproved claim that childhood vaccines are causing an epidemic of autism. Its most famous proponents are an environmentalist, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Hollywood celebrities, Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey. The Huffington Post gives a large megaphone to denialists, and Seth Nunkin, author of a new book, The Panic Virus, notes that if you want to find vaccine deniers, hang out at Whole Foods. Vaccine denial has all the hallmarks of a belief system that's not amenable to refutation. Over the past decade, the assertion that childhood vaccines are driving autism rates has been undermined by multiple epidemiological studies, as well as the simple fact that autism rates continue to rise, even though the alleged offending agent in vaccines, a mercury-based preservative called thimerosal, has long since been removed. Yet the true believers persist, critiquing each new study that challenges their views, and rallying to the defense of disgraced researcher Andrew Wakefield, even after his 1998 Lancet paper, which originated the current vaccine scare, was retracted, and he subsequently lost his license to practice medicine in the UK. But then why should we be surprised? Vaccine deniers created their own partisan media, such as the website Age of Autism, that instantly blast out critiques and counterarguments whenever any new development casts further doubt on anti-vaccine views. The upshot? Left or right, conservative or liberal, we all wear blinders in some situations. Then the question becomes, what can be done to counteract human nature itself? Well, given the power of our prior beliefs, one idea is becoming clear. If you want someone to accept new evidence, make sure to present it in a context that doesn't trigger a defensive, emotional reaction. This theory is gaining traction in part because of Kahan's work at Yale. In one study, he and his colleagues package the science of climate change into made-up newspaper articles bearing two very different headlines. Scientific panel recommends anti-pollution solutions to global warming, and scientific panel recommends nuclear solution to global warming, and then tested how citizens with different values responded. Sure enough, the latter framing made hierarchical individualists much more open to accepting the fact that humans are causing global warming. Kahan infers that the effect occurred because the science had been written into the narrative that appealed to those with a pro-industry worldview. Followed to its logical conclusion, this means conservatives are more likely to embrace climate science if it comes from a religious or business leader who can set the issue in a context of values that differ from those of environmentalist. This effectively signals a detente in what Kahan calls a culture war of fact. In other words, paradoxically, don't lead with the facts in order to convince. Lead with the values so as to give the facts a fighting chance. And now we'll turn from the last word to talking points from the Week magazine this week. Our first item is entitled, TV, Is It Still a Vast Wasteland? 50 years ago this week, Newton Menno delivered one of the most electrifying speeches ever given by a bureaucrat, said Aaron Barnhart in the Kansas City Star. The newly named head of the Federal Communications Commission boldly told a convention of the National Association of Broadcasters that the television shows they'd produced were a waste of the public airwaves. The two-word phrase he used to describe television's landscape of westerns, private eye mysteries, formulaic comedies, and game shows, a vast wasteland, has since joined the cultural lexicon as shorthand for bad TV. And half a century later, said James Warren in the New York Times, Menno's excoriation still has power. The medium has certainly evolved since 1961, but is it any better? Yes, it is, said Newton Menno in the Chicago Tribune. There's still plenty of junk on TV, but the medium is now far vaster than we could have imagined in 1961. And much of what's now available has far exceeded my most ambitious dreams. Whereas TV was once purely an entertainment medium catering to the lowest common denominator, we now have dozens of channels offering quality news and entertainment programming such as CNN, PBS, HBO, Showtime, and Arts and Entertainment, A&E. Thanks to cable, we're in an era of choice, said Tim Brooks in Advertising Age. When Menno denounced TV, there were only three networks with little room for experimentation or non-mainstream programming. Now, with the click of a remote, the average viewer can select from a world of options, from lowbrow reality TV like American Idol to intelligent drama like Mad Men to brilliant comedy like South Park. You can't call a medium tailored to so many tastes a wasteland. Give Menno's famous critique some credit for that, says Virginia Heffernan in the New York Times. Some broadcasters decided to prove him wrong, and they created the nightly news program 60 Minutes and PBS with its lineup of Sesame Street and Frontline. Other broadcasters chose to show high-minded elitists that TV could be both popular and of high quality. Thanks to their efforts, we've had golden age after golden age of TV. From Cheers to The Office, from Hill Street Blues to The Wire, from MASH to The Sopranos. Menno's smackdown of TV, in other words, may be the best thing that ever happened to the medium. Our next item, Medicare reform. The GOP gets cold feet. The public is speaking up on the Republican plan to fundamentally revamp Medicare, said Raymond Hernandez in the New York Times, and for the GOP, the news isn't good. The Medicare backlash has become a major factor in a special congressional election in western New York, where a highly popular Republican state assemblywoman, Jane Corwin, was considered a shoo-in in a solidly conservative district the GOP has controlled for decades. Then the Democrat, Kathy Hochul, launched a series of TV attack ads on the GOP plan created by Representative Paul Ryan to give future seniors a federal voucher to buy private medical insurance instead of paying their medical bills directly. Those polls now show Hochul almost erasing the Republicans' double-digit lead. At town hall meetings around the country, seniors have shown up to denounce the Ryan plan, said Chris Good in the Atlantic.com. So Republicans are now backing away. House Speaker John Boehner said last week he's not wedded to the idea, at least not in election season. The Democrats may be gleeful, said the Washington Post in an editorial, but they should be ashamed. By having the guts to take on the Medicare entitlement, Ryan gave Democrats a chance to reclaim the low ground, and they haven't hesitated. But preserving Medicare as we know it isn't an option because its costs are rising so steeply. That's why the Ryan plan, designed to control medical costs through free market competition among private insurers, deserves to be carefully evaluated, not caricatured as a radical plan to kill Medicare. Democrats have resorted to demagoguery because they've got no realistic proposal of their own, said James C. Capretta in National Review. It is wishful thinking in the extreme to think a panel of government experts can rein in costs, as President Obama proposes. The Board of Technocrats would be empowered only to make draconian cuts in payments to doctors, yet Medicare's own actuary says droves of doctors will respond to such cuts by quitting the program, leaving the elderly with few options. The Ryan plan isn't really dead, said David Nather in Politico.com. It's just off the table until after the 2012 elections. At that point, Republicans and Democrats may meet at a middle ground, knowing it could be their best chance to deal with Medicare costs. The final result won't look much like the Ryan plan or even the Obama plan, but I'll bet it will have the elements of both of them. And now let's take a look at a few short items from Talking Points here as we reach the end of our program today. The first one is the medicines recovered from Osama bin Laden's compound show he no longer suffered from kidney ailments, but he did have drugs for treating ulcers and high blood pressure, as well as Avena syrup, an extract of wild oats marketed as a natural Viagra. Bin Laden, 54 years old, was living with three wives. Higher temperatures in Europe, Africa, and Asia have reduced grain yields in recent years, costing consumers about $60 billion a year, according to a new scientific study. Researchers say their calculation is a conservative estimate of climate change's impact on food prices, since it doesn't include the impact of heat waves or flooding exacerbated by changing temperatures. One out of three adults under the age of 40 has a tattoo. The inks injected under the skin, including a new glow-in-the-dark variety, are not regulated by the FDA and can contain harmful chemicals that cause skin and immune system damage. Nobody knows for sure what's really in them, says dermatologist Tina Alster. And almost half the adults in Detroit, 47%, are functionally illiterate, a new study found. Only 10% of those who are unable to read have made attempts to learn how. Our poll watch this week, 64% of Americans agree with President Obama's decision not to release the death photos of Osama bin Laden, including 52% who strongly believe it's the right decision. 29% say the photos should be released, with 24% saying they strongly feel that way. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We certainly hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.